I'm Wade Rausch. And this is Soonish. It's the start of a new season for the show. And to kick things off, we've got a new motto. The future is shaped by technology. But technology is shaped by us. So what do I mean by that? Well, when people find out I'm a technology journalist, they always ask me, what's up with drones, or self-driving cars, or AI, or augmented reality? They've read the news, and they know that these new technologies could really change the way the world looks in the near future. But they feel kind of powerless, like it's all happening outside their control. And I don't believe that's true. Technological change isn't something that just happens to us. It's like every other kind of historical change. When you look closely, you see that it often starts with a disruptive idea from a scientist or an inventor or a company. But then it's shaped by thousands of big and small choices made by individuals like you and me. So it's important to understand where technology ideas really come from and how we decide to start using them or stop using them. Once we grasp that, we can see that we each have some choice in the matter. And then we can be a little more intentional about the kind of future we're building together. That's what the show is about. Most of the time, anyway. That's the sound of a crowd in Illinois watching the total solar eclipse that swept across the U.S. on August 21st. I was in that crowd, and for me, witnessing my first total eclipse shook me to my very core. I thought I knew what to expect. I mean, I'd studied astronomy, and I'd seen videos and maps and simulations of eclipses. But it turned out I had no freaking idea how stunning the actual eclipse would be. I've never seen anything so alien and so beautiful, so unsettling, but also in a way, so unifying. Obviously, it's been a year of disasters here in America. Not just natural disasters like hurricanes, but also moral and political disasters like the conflict in Charlottesville and the Trump administration's ongoing campaign to purge the Republic of all decency, truth, and compassion. But the eclipse was a respite from all that, if only for a couple of minutes. And for me, it was the emotional high point of a week-long road trip across America. I kept a kind of audio diary of the trip, and today, I want to play tape that I gathered at three very different stops on that journey. I'm going to tell these three stories in reverse order. That's partly because they just make more sense that way. But I'm also taking inspiration from a sign that I saw at the Pattersonville Service Plaza on the New York State Thruway. One of the restrooms at the Pattersonville stop was closed, and somebody had put up a handmade sign that said, "Temporally out of order." I had to laugh, because the sign sounded like a title that Philip K. Dick would give to a science fiction story about a time travel experiment gone haywire. Anyway, today's whole episode is going to be temporally out of order. Seeing the eclipse in Illinois was actually the first big event on my trip, but I'm going to tell that story last. And before we get there, I'm going to take you to the spot that has more Confederate monuments than any other place in America. A hint for you, it's not in the South. And I'm going to visit a town whose very name stands for hope and the future. But it's a place that's now so depopulated that it has its own entry on a site called the Encyclopedia of Forlorn Places. I said before that it's important for us to think more intentionally about the future. Right now, we're having a lot of trouble coming together to do that. And as I drove across the country, hitting 10 states altogether, I could see one of the reasons. We haven't even settled big questions about how we should represent the past, or who should have a chance to prosper in the present. William Faulkner's famous line was that the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. And sometimes it feels like we have so much unfinished business that we'll never be able to move on to the future. But then along comes something like a hurricane or an eclipse, a rare natural event that reminds us that despite our divisions, we're all passengers on this planet together, and we're all part of something much bigger. So, in the spirit of that epic spelling accident on the New York State Thruway, we'll start with the third of our three acts. Here's Act 3, Crossing the Picket Line. The battles we remember best are the turning points, like Saratoga, Waterloo, the Somme, Midway, Stalingrad. And in the American Civil War, the turning point was at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, That's where Confederate General Robert E. Lee tried to crush the Union Army over three bloody days of fighting on July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863. It's where he failed. And that failure was the beginning of the end for the Confederate States of America. Now, I have a PhD in history, and my dad's a huge Civil War buff, who's got practically every book ever written on the subject. But I'd never been to Gettysburg. Now I had a chance to fix that, since my route to the Eclipse Zone went right through Pennsylvania. Also, Charlottesville was on my mind. On August 11th, of course, white nationalists and neo-Nazis gathered there to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. And the next day, one man who'd marched with the white nationalists drove a car into a crowd of counter-protesters and killed an activist named Heather Heyer. So I figured it was a fitting time to visit Gettysburg, which has so many Confederate and Union monuments that you can barely turn around without bumping into one. There's probably no place where our cultural memory of the Civil War is more concentrated, or where the actual meaning of the war gets more occluded by the tales of bravery and slaughter on the battlefield. Now, from watching Ken Burns' documentaries, I expected to be impressed by Gettysburg, and I was. The battlefields were beautifully mowed and manicured, and the place was so sunny and peaceful that it was hard to imagine that 50,000 soldiers were injured or killed here in just 3 days. I also expected to hear people talking about all the statues and what they symbolize, and I kind of did. I'd just gotten out of my car to look at the giant statue of Robert E. Lee at a spot called the Virginia Memorial when a minivan pulled up and a family of six piled out. The dad said, "You better hurry up and take a picture. They might want to tear this thing down." And the mom said, "Yeah, somebody might be offended." They lined up their four kids in front of the statue and snapped their pictures and drove away. I didn't get a chance to ask where they were from, but their minivan had Connecticut plates. So make of that what you will. But here's what I didn't expect to see. I was reading a plaque about Pickett's Charge when a group of about 40 white guys got off a bus and formed up into a platoon about 8 guys wide and 5 guys deep. Oh, they're marching, and they're coming this way. This will be interesting. I'm going to station myself here while they march by.
You, random human, do you wish to come with us?
Absolutely.
Fall in. Two. Four. Four. A word small.
When the staff sergeant guy asked if I wanted to join them, I instantly said yes, because when you're a podcaster and stuff like this happens, you just go with it.
Right shoulder, arm.
But then it gradually dawned on me what we were doing. We were recreating Pickett's Charge, the big Confederate offensive on the third day of Gettysburg. 12,000 soldiers started out roughly where the Virginia Memorial is today, and they marched 3/4 of a mile across a hayfield toward the Union line on Cemetery Ridge, taking huge casualties all the way. And without knowing it, I had signed up to play a Confederate infantryman.
Dress it. Just right. Colors are on the right. Just a few random, not really accurate artillery fires hitting right now. We've already lost about 20 guys. We've gone down from there to here. Not 20 guys in this formation, but 20 guys in our regiment. Out of 300 guys. Okay. Platoon, attention. Hon! Forward. Hard.
For the next half hour or so, we trampled through thick fields of hay and soybean plants. And as we went, we were kicking up a big cloud of grasshoppers and butterflies. If I squinted, I could sort of imagine that the bugs were a hail of bullets. I still didn't understand the exact point of recreating Pickett's Charge, unless it was to take in the insane desperation of the whole thing. But as the random human, I felt like I was committed. So I kept marching.
Two. Halt. We arranged a musketry fire. Big lead, 1 ounce slugs are flying around. We've lost 56, we just lost another 10. 66 guys are down. Wounded or dead. At this point, you close ranks. Where they fell, you close in. We have the random human. Sir, we're honored to have you join us. Forward, hard. Forward, double time, hard.
Thank you.
puzzle.
I will move off.
All right, and by this time, when the attack stops, Lee rides out to meet them, and they all try to go back. General Lee is being dangerous. He rides out and he says, "It's all right, man. It's all my fault. It's my plan. I failed. It was my fault." "Oh, sir, no, it was you." And he puts his hand on Longstreet's shoulder and says the same thing. "It wasn't you. It was me." Okay, he takes responsibility for failure. The Confederates now suffer two great defeats. They lose the Mississippi River. They lose this one decisive battle that was going to bring them victory, but they fight on two more bloody years. They go to the Wilderness, Champaign, Spotsylvania, Petersburg, Appomattox. So let me just say that one other thing. The conduct of this formation going across that field was excellent. Everybody's tripping and falling. I didn't hear any moans, no snivels, no talk. So I commend this. I think you guys have made it. I'm ready for someone to try to knock down a monument right now. I think we can take them. We find it as a fighting outfit.
Sir, can I ask you, what were you up to? What is this whole thing?
These are a company out of various places. So they bring all their executives, mid-level, top level, lower level, at some point out to Gettysburg to teach them something about leadership. And the battlefield becomes a metaphor for things they should do in their business. You know, what happens here in leadership can be directly put into what these guys do when they handle their businesses.
Do you run these kinds of leadership exercises as a profession, or what do you do?
I'm an old soldier and a historian. I taught military history at West Point. So the companies asked me to come out and do this with them. Anytime I get a chance to get Americans out and kind of feel the courage and history of this place, I take the opportunity.
And your name, sir?
My name's Hank Kersey.
Well, thank you, sir. I really appreciate your time, and this was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. Very few humans would do that, so your character shows.
All right.
All right. God bless
you. Take care. Thank you.
You got to go back?
Yeah, I'm going back that way.
All right.
On my long walk back across the battlefield to my car, I had time to think about what had just happened. I was a little angry with myself, to be honest, for going along with the whole thing, even if it was in the name of journalism. The other guys in the platoon didn't look like racists, and I can buy the idea that the march was designed to teach them about leadership, not to glorify George Pickett or Robert E. Lee or the Lost Southern Cause. But the truth is, if I were black, I probably wouldn't have felt as safe joining up with a group of pretend Confederates. And let's face it, it's a little weird that we still talk about Confederate generals as if they were great and courageous leaders. Yeah, sure, if you were in the infantry that day, it took individual courage to follow Lee's orders. The horrifying casualty rate proves that. But what we still don't talk about as much is what Lee and his army were fighting for. To put it bluntly, it was the idea that white people should forever have the right to own and buy and sell black people. There's no courage in that idea. There's only prejudice and greed and hate. And that's why Confederate monuments in Charlottesville and so many other places are finally being taken down. The tide is slowly turning. It's turning against the idea that it's okay to memorialize an era of unchallenged white supremacy. And sooner or later, that tide may come to Gettysburg. After Charlottesville, officials at the National Park Service said that the Confederate monuments at Gettysburg are, quote, an important part of the cultural landscape, unquote, and that there are no plans to remove or alter any of them. You can see why the Park Service would take that position, given that Gettysburg is basically a giant outdoor museum. But I wonder how long they'll be able to stick to it. Because a good museum doesn't glorify its artifacts, it puts them in context. And the Virginia Memorial, where Pickett's charge began, isn't there to contextualize anything. It's only there to deify Robert E. Lee and his doomed army. So, yeah, somebody might be offended. That brings us to Act Two of our story. Act Two, Trouble in Future City. One day this summer, during the planning phase for my Eclipse trip, I was looking at the state of Illinois on Google Maps, and my eye landed on a place I had never heard of. It was called Future City. It was just outside Cairo, Illinois, at the southernmost tip of the state, in a little cup of land where the Ohio River and the Mississippi River come together. From the satellite view on Google Maps, I could see eight or so streets in Future City, arranged in a tight grid, but it looked like there weren't any businesses or houses. So right away, I had questions. Does anyone live in Future City? If so, who, and what are their lives like? How did it get the name Future City? And does the place have a future? Or is it just the world's most ironically named ghost town? Since I make a podcast about the future, I felt obliged to find out.
Turn right onto New Cross Street, then your destination will be on the left.
Okay, it's 4:15 on the 21st of August, 2017, and I am in Future City. So let's drive around a bit. Okay. This is not uninhabited. Whoa, there's a dog. Hello, dog. Hi, how are you? Okay, I'm down at the end of First Avenue, and there is an old abandoned gas station here. I'm following Bruce Street around to the back. It's basically like a cow path. Really tall weeds, like 6 feet on both sides. There is the street sign for Bruce Street and 4th Avenue. Not a terribly busy street. All right, continuing down 4th Avenue. I think I'm going to park and walk around and see if I can find somebody to talk to me. Gentlemen, do you have a minute to talk? Hey. Okay. How are you? I'm a good guy. He looks friendly. Hey, this is going to sound crazy, but I'm a radio reporter.
Yeah.
And I saw this place on the map called Future City.
Future City.
And I had to stop here to find out what is Future City all about.
It's still in the making, in the future. It's a city in the future. I don't think it's going to make it.
It's a city in the future, man.
In the future.
Do you guys have a minute to talk? These two gentlemen were sitting in the shade of a carport with their dog, and they introduced themselves as Carl Thompson and Larry Sloan. They were both retired Vietnam veterans. Carl was in the Army, and Larry was in the Air Force. I asked them why there are so many streets and so few houses in Future City.
That was the thing, man, to build a future in Future City. That's why they call it Future City.
You'd be surprised.
Because they thought you could build a future here, you know. So when most of these people moved out here, they had kids, man. They had usually on an average of 2 kids per household. Kids could play together, you know, and run around together and all that stuff. And that was the future of Future City. They the future generation of Future City.
Larry and Carl both said that if I really wanted to know about the history of Future City, the guy I should talk to was the mayor, Dennis Caldwell. And they pointed me toward Caldwell's house, about 100 yards away, across a field. But before I could head over there, the mayor himself came out of the house and got in his pickup, and Carl and Larry flagged him down for me.
Come here.
He's the man. Yeah, he's a lifelong resident of here, man.
Yeah, you come here. He want to know about Future City. I don't know.
Huh?
I'm a radio reporter, and I've been talking with these gentlemen. They've been telling me a little bit about the town, and they said, you're the mayor.
No, I'm saying they got me wrong.
I said, he would know more about it than I do. I'm just new here.
Well, the only thing I know about Future City was it was named after a lady to the old folks. Her name was Martha Future. She's supposed to come from out the South.
Martha Future?
Uh-huh.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Do you know when this was?
I have no idea
when
this was.
Okay.
But this is just what I heard the old people say back years ago.
Yeah?
That it was named after an old lady come here from out of the South, and they named it Martha Future.
Okay.
And I can't tell the rest of the story because I don't know how true it is. Because somebody said that she was kin to my grandpa.
No way.
I never did no research on it. I don't know whether it was true or what.
Like a cousin or a sister?
I didn't get into that. I didn't even try that, you know.
Is there like a historical society in Cairo or a library somewhere?
Yeah, they got a library down there, right on the main street there. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could find out there. And have you lived here all your life?
About 20 or 30 years.
20 or 30 years?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How'd you choose to live here in Future City?
I married my wife here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, this place here used to be nothing but houses here.
Yeah?
This is about Actually, it was probably around about 400 or 500 families there.
400 or 500?
Oh, yeah. It was this road out here.
51?
51 going through used to set back over this way, about where the ditch going through. And there was houses all out there. This was back in the 60s, let's see, 67, I believe it was. 68, that's when they started building that road and moved it over.
They moved the road?
Uh-huh.
And was that the beginning of the decline of the town? Or, I mean, I don't mean to...
Well, the decline of the town when the civil rights started.
How so?
Back in the 60s.
Yeah.
That's when the town started going down.
Why? What was the connection there?
Racism. They didn't want to hire black into the stores and things. You know, there was a lot of stuff back then.
So did people pick up and leave?
Well, a lot of people, the business, you know, they left. Yeah, they quit, went out of business, and
right.
It's no business here.
How many families do you think live here now?
One, two, three, four, five, six, about 9 families.
So that's like less than a tenth of the old population.
Yeah, right, wow. right.
I noticed there's a Shiloh Baptist Church over there. Is that still active?
The church, yeah, that old church just up here on the road, yeah, it's still active. Uh-huh. It used to sit right there across the road there where those concrete barrels are sitting at. They moved it.
Why?
That's when the road come through.
Sounds like that road really, moving the road disrupted everything.
That road, it really did. It was just like I say, it was a popular place.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Future City was a popular place.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. I appreciate it. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Thanks, man.
All right, man.
Great talking to you.
All right.
After those interviews, I drove south into Cairo to visit the public library and see what I could find out about Martha Future. It turned out that the library was closed that day. But after driving around town, I finally understood Future City's geographical predicament. Cairo is surrounded by a system of extremely high levees and flood walls. From the north, you come into the city through a tunnel that cuts through one of those walls. The city can close off the tunnel during a flood by lowering an 80-ton steel slab called the Big Subway Gate. And Future City sits right outside the gate.
Right. Well, the problem with it is it does flood. It gets what we call seep water out there, and it does flood the residences, and it has flooded before when the rivers were high. And when the rivers start going down, then this land becomes inundated with flood water.
That's Monica Smith, the director of the Cairo Public Library.
And so it has moved many people out. Used to, some of the houses were even on stilts out there. But it's just been, it's hard to maneuver. You can't get in and out. You have to have a boat and different things. And so the people have just, decided it wasn't really worth it, you know.
I called up Smith after my trip, mainly to ask if she could find any information about Martha Future. Or if not, then how did the place get the name Future City?
One of the reasons is because there was no place for Carol to go. They were surrounded on both sides by rivers. And so they thought that that would be the future of the city. But then digging further, I find that it was actually owned by a gentleman named Futrell.
To be specific, Smith said she'd found some newspaper clippings about a landowner named Will Futrell.
And he and another landowner had purchased all the lots out there and were selling those lots at a very nominal fee for like $100 a lot to get people to move there. And over the years, no one could pronounce his name because it was kind of a hard thing to pronounce. And so they used the southern pronunciation and started calling it Future City instead of Futrell City, which is kind of hard to say. So that's about all I really found on it.
Okay. Well, you completely answered my question, and I am so grateful. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
So maybe Martha Future was related somehow to Will Futrell. Or maybe that whole Martha story that Dennis Caldwell heard from the town elders was just an urban legend. But Caldwell was right about one thing, and that was the mark that the racial conflicts of the 1960s left on Cairo and its surroundings. The Civil War turned Cairo into a busy port city, and by 1920, the Census Bureau counted 15,000 residents. But by 1960, the economy was reeling from a decline in river and rail traffic, and the population had dropped by nearly half. Things got really tough starting in 1967, when black residents rose up to protest police brutality and economic discrimination. Riots and fires ravaged the city, and the businesses that closed never reopened. As I drove around Cairo, I could see that big chunks of the downtown are still empty and abandoned. At the south end of town, I saw a giant white billboard that welcomes people to historic Cairo, but it looked like it hadn't been repainted in decades. And I found a Census Bureau estimate that the city's population today is just 2,400, in a place built for six times that number. If Future City has a future, it's tied to Cairo's. Unfortunately, the flood wall doesn't keep out bad news. I'm not sure whether to believe the Martha Future story or the Will Futrell story, but either way, there's some comfort in the idea that this unlucky place was named after a person. Because that's a little less heartbreaking than the idea that it was named for a dream.
Friends, the idle brain is the devil's playground. Trouble! Oh,
yeah, trouble!
Right here in River City. With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for
fool.
We've surely got trouble.
We surely got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Gotta
figure out a way to keep the young ones moral after school.
Before we wrap up, I want to take a moment to tell you about all the people who make Soonish possible. The show is supported in part by Kent Rasmussen Winery of California. Rasmussen has been famous since 1986 for their purely poetic Pinot Noir, grown in the cool mists of the Carneros region of Napa Valley. And under the Companion Ramsey label, they offer superior quality North Coast Pinot Noir, Merlot, Petit Sirah, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Chardonnay at a wonderful price. Take a bottle of this finely made wine to your next dinner party, and you'll be sure to impress. For more information, visit KentRasmussenWinery.com. Soonish is also supported by the wonderful listeners who've made pledges on Patreon, including our newest patrons, Chuck and Gail Mandeville, Ellen Liance, Tracy Stetter, Nick Morozovsky, Mark Pulofsky, Deborah Rossum, and Bob Mason. If you enjoy the show and you want to help keep it going into our second season and beyond, please go to patreon.com/soonish. Check out the awesome rewards available at various pledge levels, and give what you can. And thanks. One more thing. You might remember the episode from the first season where I talked about why all of our technologies for personal productivity seem to be failing us. At 7 p.m. on Monday, November 6th, I'll be revisiting that topic in a live talk at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline, Massachusetts. Right after my talk, we'll watch the classic comedy Office Space, directed by Mike Judge. The Coolidge calls Office Space a smart takedown of corporate culture about a group of underappreciated, overworked drones and their clash with management and computer printers. It's all part of the Coolidge's Science on Screen series, supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. You can buy tickets online right now at coolidge.org. And if you sign up to support Soonish on Patreon at the $25 level or above, you're welcome to attend free as my guest. I hope you can join us on November 6th. Finally, we've arrived at Act 1 in our Out of Order episode. Act 1, Total Eclipse plus some art. If you're a fan of the show, you may remember a special guest from Episode 3, Tamar Avishai. She's the host of a wonderful, gripping, and luminous podcast about art history called The Lonely Palette. She and I are actually cooking up something new that I'll tell you about in a future episode. But in early August, I found out that Tamar and her husband, Evan, were also going to Illinois to see the eclipse. So we agreed to text each other when we got there and try to meet up somewhere near Carbondale. Now, as it turned out, the place where the eclipse would last the longest was actually a tiny town south of Carbondale called Makanda. It's so small and out of the way that there isn't even a cellular signal, but that's where we all met. I'm going to play you some tape from Makanda, and you'll meet a bunch of interesting people. You'll also get a sense of what a carnival the whole thing was. And when the eclipse starts, you'll hear everyone totally freaking out. But I just want to preface all of it with this. No recording can capture the splendor of an eclipse. The only way to grasp the howling cosmic weirdness of it all is to see one yourself. Before August 21st, I didn't understand why some people become lifelong eclipse chasers. Now I do. Okay. It's 10 past 10, and I am in Makanda, Illinois. Or Makanda. I'll find out soon from the locals.
And Makanda is really not much more than a bridge, a railway station, and a downtown that's about three buildings long. I'm going to walk over there in a minute, see if I can talk to some people.
Smalls only. Hello.
Hi, do you mind if we talk for a second?
We can talk for as long as I've got time.
Okay, that's fine, yeah. So could you introduce yourself just quickly?
I'm Pam. I'm from PB&J. I'm the PN PB&J.
And what's PB&J?
Pam, Bob, and Jackie. It's a little junk store.
Isn't junk.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's good junk, but it's junk. It's all junk.
How's business today?
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Is this like your biggest day ever?
I don't know yet. It hasn't happened, but it's looking like it could be.
Just quickly, how many people live in Makanda or Makanda? How do you pronounce it, first of all?
Makanda. We're not fancy.
Makanda.
Makanda. Okay. And it depends on which side you come into town from. If you come in from 51, it says we have 600. If you come in from the park, it says 450.
Which do you believe?
The 450. There okay. may be 600 people out there in rural Makanda, but we never see them.
Thank you so much, Pam, and good luck today.
Thank you very much. Okay, have a goodbye. Lovely day.
Thank you.
Unregulated.
Can I sing a little song? I'm a song and dance
Absolutely.
Man.
Please do.
Oh, God bless you. I'm just kidding. You know how to shut a guy a big mouth up, don't you?
I'm an audio producer. I never say no to people who want to talk or sing.
Oh, that's funny.
Are you
that's
here funny. To see the eclipse? Duh.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, this is my last opportunity. I probably won't be around for the next one.
It's only 7 years away.
I'm a smoker and a drinker.
Well.
Yeah, it shouldn't be long now.
Are you here with some of the craftspeople here?
Yes, actually the owner of the shop.
Oh, this shop right here, Rainmaker.
Yeah, exactly. Owned by Dave Dardis, who's been on getting national exposure on TV, hence the line.
What does this line represent?
The center of the total eclipse.
Are you serious?
I am serious. They had a surveyor come, and they decided this is the line.
There's this orange line painted down the asphalt here, and it even continues up the wall.
The
and
shop.
On the sign, even the ND in Makanda is in orange.
Indeed.
So this is the line where the zone of totality will last the longest.
Absolutely.
That's pretty remarkable.
Now you were there as well as us.
I'm standing right on it.
You are.
My name is Biscuit.
And you're doing painted faces here, am I right?
Yes, I'm painting faces here. I have fun, I make a little money, and it spreads joy amongst people. They like it.
And what brings you to Makanda today?
Friends. I've known the guys down here for 40 years, so I just wanted to come hang out and get funky and cosmic with them.
And maybe do a little business.
Yeah, we need it here. We do. We have all had our hopes up for this one, you know.
Hey, how's it going?
Been busy. It's been very busy. We actually had to stop serving breakfast for a while because the biscuits and the gravy kept going.
Amazing.
But it's been very helpful, and today is actually our 1 year, so it's been very successful.
Congratulations. Can I get a cherry Coke?
$2. I need a cherry Coke.
I just noticed that there's a flag outside of the Rainmaker studio. That says United Federation of Planets. I'm going to walk around the back and see if I can find this yellow line.
We travel night and day. Baby, running all the way home, we're trying to get to you. We run a night and day. Baby, running all the way home, we're trying to get to you. All right. Thank you, Makanda.
Recording people's stories, or
yeah, do you have a story?
Yeah, today is me and my wife's 30th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations!
If I would have been a betting guy or something like that, and you said I'll give you like 1,000 to 1 that there's an eclipse 30 years to the day where you're married right here under the altar, I would have said no, I won't take that bet. But it happened. I would have been rich.
There is a rumor that there is some kind of sky dragon that is going to take a bite out of the sun. I cannot verify this. I just gleefully announce the rumors that I've heard.
Okay, it's 12:18, and the eclipse is like 20%. Let's do a swing through the crowd and see if I can find Tamar and her friends.
Oh, hi. I thought it would feel more commercialized, you know? I feel like I imagine that people would be taking advantage of it too much. And it's like everyone around here is just like, there was a van that said Eclipse Glass is $5, and he just was like basically kind of like tossing them like out the window. He was just giving them away for free, and I handed him $5 anyway because it's like, this is for, you know, I mean, we wanted this so badly. Thank you for providing this service. But other than that, it's just like everybody is just like, we've needed something to bring us together, you know, so badly. And everyone is just looking up and smiling at each other. And, you know, it's like we've needed a little bit of a reminder that the universe is bigger than us.
That is so well put.
Yeah, and the nice thing about there being no service, because there is no service, no one is looking at their phones. And I don't know, it feels a little, what's the word, kind of medieval. It's like everybody has to look up and talk to each other. And everybody has to, like, I was walking around here yelling Wade, like yelling your name to find you, because I knew that was the only way that that would happen, if that happened. So, you know, it's like it feels connective to a before us.
I've gotten some amazing interviews today from all sorts of people, and they're all just like half out of their minds just because it's like a crazy, it's one of those days. You like, you get a carnival. It's a carnival. That's what it is.
Yeah. No, I'm feeling out of my mind too. I feel like I'm on the verge of tears, like just walking around and seeing everybody united for this thing. And then you know, you put the Eclipse glasses on and you look up and it's like, it's happening. It's like childbirth. It's like, it's happening whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Evan.
Wait, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Doing well.
We found each other.
So this is my brother-in-law, Jason.
Good to meet you.
Jason?
My mother.
Yep. Hi,
Liz.
I'm Wade.
Good to meet you, Wade.
Hi, Wade. I'm Liz. I'm Evan's mom. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I'm Wade.
Hi, I'm Callie.
Callie.
Evan's sister.
Yeah, it's good to meet all of you.
I'm Paul. Evan's
Paul,
dad.
Hi.
Like, it's so amazing. Like, I can't believe this is actually happening right now, you know? Like, it's like, oh, yeah, it's going to get dark in, like, a little less than an hour.
Nobody told me your name. What's your name again?
My name's Genevieve.
Genevieve. And what's your name?
Vivian.
Those are great names.
But that's really cool because, like, the moon is covering up the sun. Because, like, when you think about how big the sun is, like, compared to our Earth, the sun is, like, humongous. And then compared to our moon, like, that's, like, crazy. Like,
yeah.
It's, like, yeah, it's amazing that this, like, this little, like, rock is, like, blocking out the sun.
I like the moon, too. Like, the moon is ours. It's like our little buddy who's, you know, sticks by us and every now and then gets this moment in the sun, you know? Like, this time to really kind of show us what it's made of. And then, you know, it just goes back to being the beautiful kind of, you know, ocean-pulling Earth mother.
Imagine if, like, the light were like this all the time, though.
Guys, I know there's an eclipse happening, but ice cream truck!
It feels like the world is, like the atmosphere just put on some sunglasses or something.
That's,
you know,
exact,
like,
yeah.
The atmosphere is just, like, this giant camera with, like, a filter on it or something like that.
That,
you know,
what
that's
it
what
feels
it feels like.
Like
right now.
It's so weird.
Like, what also makes this really cool is that there is no way to capture it other than to just be there, to feel everything get dimmer. You just have to be here.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So weird.
Yeah.
It's full daylight and it feels like it's almost night.
Oh, it's just getting dimmer and dimmer, but not like night. Like,
and there isn't a cloud anywhere near the sun. We are totally golden.
Okay. Make sure you look through the glasses if you look at the sun, okay?
There it goes. There it goes. It's going. It's going.
Put your glasses on that. 8, 7.
Oh my God! Oh my God, I can't believe it! She's a star! planet. Oh my God. I don't believe it. I can't believe it.
Oh my God, it's beautiful.
Oh. That's way better than I expected.
Wow. You know, it's like I wanna describe this, but you can't.
You can't. It's amazing. Do you hear the insects starting up?
Yes, yes.
Oh, they're gonna be disappointed.
The bugs. Those poor bugs.
The ones that don't have the internal clocks. So, like, you know,
those are the really dumb bugs.
Yeah, they just. They just rely on the sunlight.
Oh my God.
And just the beautiful rays coming out around it.
It's incredible. Like, going in three or four different directions.
Yeah, like when kids draw what a sun looks like. You never actually get to see that.
If you look right outside the glow, you can see a tiny little star.
But no wonder people freaked out,
you know. I don't care. You can, it's starting to a little bit.
Wow, and the sun comes back out. And the light comes back up. And the whole town reemerges from the darkness. Suddenly it seems brighter than it was before.
Yeah.
I feel like this is going faster.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It was so funny. It didn't take long at all for it to get light again because the sun is so bright.
Yeah.
And it was so suddenly like
awesome.
Hey!
All right, what does that say?
I survived the total solar eclipse.
I
can't read the whole shirt.
It's
of 2017.
Congratulations. I think we all survived.
Yes, we did.
That's amazing. Look, it's getting
lighter. See, now everyone is just over it, even though
everybody's trying to get out of town.
The sun is still, you know, mostly occluded by the shadow, but it's like, you know, we've seen what it can be. We were both struck that it was smaller in the sky than we thought it would be. And that it didn't necessarily, to me at least, feel like this huge transcendent experience, but it was beautiful. It was just, you know, just one of the most beautiful things you can see in the sky, even though it wasn't huge. And the sky is something that we all think we know pretty well. And it's just rare for something to be different in it, and it takes something enormous for it to be different, that I can see why people try to have this experience as much as they can.
It was both shorter and longer than I expected. 2.5 minutes felt like a long time, like we could just look at it forever, and it was just glittering there. And it was way more beautiful and precise and crystalline and alive than I expected. I was completely overcome, which everybody says that's what's going to happen to you, and you just can't really understand it or explain it until it happens.
Excuse me, but there's ice cream being bought, so
time to make this truly the best day ever.
Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. The show's theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. Additional music this week by Tim Beek and Lee Rosevere. You can find and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Radio Public, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow and like the show on Facebook, and I tweet about the show at Soonish Podcast. If you enjoy Soonish, it really helps when you leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. That truly does raise the odds that other smart listeners like you will find the show. Soonish is a proud member at the PRX Podcast Garage, a community recording studio and workspace in Alston, Massachusetts. For more information, go to podcastgarage.org. At our website, soonishpodcast.org,
You'll find more information about all the people and places in this episode, as well as our music playlist, and a page where you can sign up for our free email newsletter, Signals from Soonish. I've also posted my eclipse video from Makanda, and I have to tell you, it's kind of awesome. Special thanks this week to Kip Clark, Mark Pulowski, Daniel Sheehan, Hank Kersey, Carl Thompson, Larry Sloan, Dennis Caldwell, Monica Smith at the Carroll Public Library, the intrepid citizens of Makanda, Illinois, and of course, Tamar Avishai and her whole family. Thanks also to our sponsor, Kent Rasmussen Winery, and their purely poetic Pinot Noir. And thank you for listening. I'll be back with a new episode soonish.
Cheers. Cheers to the Corona.
Yeah.
A little lime in there. You got yourself an eclipse. Thank you.